In the mid-1990s, the city of Baltimore was attacked by an epidemic of syphilis. In the space of a year, from 1995 to 1996, the number of children born with the disease increased by 500%. If you look at Baltimore's syphilis rates on a graph, the line runs straight for years, and then, when it hits 1995, rises almost at a right angle. What caused Baltimore's syphilis problem to tip? According to the Centers for Disease Control, the problem was crack cocaine. Crack is known to cause a dramatic increase in the kind of risky sexual behavior that leads to the spread of things like HIV and syphilis. It brings far more people into poor areas to buy drugs, which then increases the likelihood of them taking an infection home with them to their own neighborhood. It changes the patterns of social connections between neighborhoods. Crack, the CDC said, was the little push that the syphilis problem needed to turn into a raging epidemic. John Zellman, a sexually transmitted disease expert at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, has another explanation: the breakdown of medical services in the city's poorest neighborhoods. In 1990-91, we had 36,000 patient visits at the city's clinics, Zellman says. Then the city decided to gradually cut back because of budgetary problems. The number of clinicians went from 17 to 10. The number of physicians went from 3 to essentially nobody. Patient visits dropped to 21,000. There was also a similar drop in the amount of field outreach staff. When there were 36,000 patient visits a year in the STD clinics of Baltimore's inner city, in other words, the disease was kept in an equilibrium. At some point between 36,000 and 21,000 patient visits a year, the disease erupted. Suddenly, people who may have been infectious for a week before getting treated were now going around infecting others for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks before they got cured. The breakdown in treatment made syphilis a much bigger issue than it had been before. There is a third theory which belongs to John Potterat, one of the country's leading epidemiologists. His culprits are the physical changes in those years affecting East and West Baltimore, the heavily depressed neighborhoods on either side of Baltimore's downtown, where the syphilis problem was centered. In the mid-1990s, he points out, the city of Baltimore embarked on a highly publicized policy of dynamiting the old 1960s-style public housing high-rises in East and West Baltimore. Two of the most publicized demolitions, Lexington Terrace in West Baltimore and Lafayette Courts in East Baltimore, were huge projects housing hundreds of families that served as centers for crime and infectious disease. At the same time, people began to move out of the old row houses in East and West Baltimore, as those began to deteriorate as well. It was absolutely striking, Potterat says, of the first time he toured East and West Baltimore. 50% of the row houses were boarded up, and there was also a process where they destroyed the projects. What happened was a kind of hollowing out. This fueled the diaspora. Whereas syphilis for years had been confined to a specific socio-geographic region of Baltimore, within highly confined socio-sexual networks, the housing dislocation process served to move those people to other parts of the city. They took their syphilis and other behaviors with them. What is interesting about these explanations is that none of them are at all dramatic. The CDC thought that crack was the problem, but it wasn't as if crack came to Baltimore for the first time in 1995. It had been there for years. What they were saying is that there had been a subtle increase in the severity of the crack problem in the mid-1990s, and that that change had been enough to set off the syphilis epidemic. Zellman, likewise, wasn't saying that STD clinics in Baltimore were shut down. They were simply scaled back, the number of clinicians cut from 17 to 10. And nor was Potterat saying that all of Baltimore was hollowed out. All it took, he said, was the demolition of a handful of housing projects and the abandonment of homes in key downtown neighborhoods to send syphilis over the top. It takes only the smallest of changes to shatter an epidemic's equilibrium. The second, and perhaps more interesting, fact about these explanations is that all of them are describing a very different way of tipping an epidemic. The CDC is talking about the overall context for the disease, how the introduction and growth of an addictive drug can so change the environment of a city that it can cause a disease to tip. Zellman is talking about the disease itself. When the clinics were cut back, syphilis was given a second life. It had been an acute infection. It was now a chronic infection. It had become a lingering problem and stayed around for weeks. Potterat was focused on the people who were carrying syphilis. Syphilis, he was saying, was a disease carried by a certain kind of person in Baltimore, a very poor, probably drug-using, sexually active individual. If that kind of person was suddenly transported from their old neighborhood to a new one, the disease would have an opportunity to tip. There is more than one way to tip an epidemic, in other words. Epidemics are a function of the people who transmit infectious agents, the infectious agent itself, and the environment in which the infectious agent is operating. And when an epidemic tips, when it is jolted out of equilibrium, it tips because something has happened. Some change has occurred in one or two or three of those areas. These three agents of change I call the law of the few, the stickiness factor, and the power of context.